In baseball, they give you the ball. In football, they give you the ball. In basketball, they give you the ball except for the tip-off. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Hockey, you take it away. No matter how I get it, I got to take it away. You got to fight for every possession. So it's physical contact. It isn't like football. Football is a pussy game. You know, hockey is a different game. Hockey is a game played by guys with tremendous heart and tremendous courage. And courage is a serious element to playing the game. It isn't meant for the faint of heart.
Moore fights to keep it in. Does has it in the corner to Sanderson. Back in front to Orr. Shot scores! Bobby Orr from Sanderson! And what could be better than that? As they beat St. Louis 4-3. Orr to Sanderson, back to Orr, and they go wild. And Orr fell down in the corner, and they have surrounded him. What a scene, John.
After 40 seconds of play, Bobby Orr.
The first section of your book is... there's some hockey sprinkle in there, but, you know, it really struck me as just a good coming-of-age story, you know?
It was. I was a young kid. I loved hockey. I had, you know, I grew up in what they call wartime housing. Today it would be considered the project. But I was poor, but I didn't know I was poor. Right? Mm-hmm. I didn't know I was poor. So, you know, we played hockey out the backyard, and we ate well, and, you know, not fast. I mean, of course, it wasn't caviar and cordon bleu. It was, you know, a different world. And I grew up, there was 40, probably 46 of us in the neighborhood. And we hung out together. We played all sports. We played baseball all summer, and we played swimming, and we swam, and... there was no four leagues and all that dedication. I never played, actually, in an arena with boards and blue lines until I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was entirely different.
So it was just pond hockey back then?
Yeah, when I was eight, and then I signed up for the Little League, Little Legion, and you were 8 years old, and you played Pee Wee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pee Wee, and then you went to Bantam, and then you went to Midget, and the Boston Bruins bought me when I was 11, I think. And they traded me twice before I was 13, and they got me back.
I thought it was pretty interesting how you talked about in the book how there were kids in the neighborhood who knew you were Bruins property, so they were kind of, you know, juvenile delinquents.
Well, my neighborhood was a rough neighborhood. I've got friends of mine in my neighborhood have never had a social security number, never had a job.
Mm-hmm.
They run everything from Toronto to Buffalo. They run Niagara Peninsula. So things were different, you know. But they said, hey, listen, you're not going to do anything criminal. You're gonna work hard. You're the only one that'll get out of here. They protected me my whole life. No one could hurt me. No one could say anything about me. They were there was the toughest gang. I had about the toughest group. Not a gang to speak of, but say, like it is today. It took some blood or any of that nonsense. No killing, none of that. It was all fist fighting and kicking and shooting. You know, shooting today is, you know, every shoot that. Then it was just being tough.
So when you came up through Niagara Falls, and then when you made the Bruins, when you stuck with the Bruins, besides what was going on in your hockey world, you say,
mm-hmm.
you said in the book you learned to love and you learned to drink in Boston. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, in Boston, I came to Boston pretty well for all extents and purposes, a virgin. I mean, you know, you have your you know, flashes of, sex, and, you know, think you know what you're doing. You don't have a clue. And it's always embarrassing, and it's always a non-starter, you know? I said, well, geez, I better get good at that. I have to work at this. But it's a different world when you come here, and the women were faster. But see, people forget the era. You have no concept. For me to explain, how old are you?
34.
You have no concept. No concept of the 70s. The pill was invented when? 1956, 58? Okay, that was women's freedom. Forget Gloria Steinem and all the other bullshit. As soon as they could have sex without getting pregnant, that's when they went out on their own. They spread their wings and said, see you later. As soon as that could happen, that they had equality with men, that men didn't get pregnant, they didn't get pregnant, let's have at it. That's an entirely different world. You remember in 1965, there were 3 nightclubs in America where a girl could go unattended and not be considered a prostitute. The Peppermint Lounge in Detroit, the Candy Store in Los Angeles, right? And Bachelor's 3 was a singles bar in New York. Joe Namath, Ray Abruzzi, and Bobby Vannucci were the 3 guys that owned the one in New York. But the NFL shut that down, and they offered, and Namath retired because of it on principle, which was, I thought, pretty brave at the time.
About those early Bruins teams, those are in the top 5 teams of all time, probably, in the NHL.
All time. You know something? I don't care how many. You take Gretzky, you take Lemieux, you take all these great teams, right? The Islanders. Of all of them, the only one that would have given us trouble would have been the Islanders.
You think so?
They had great goaltending, great defense, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Islanders were very tough, could play both ways. The Islanders were a different team. And, and they won't be looked upon as, Bossy was an exceptional scorer,
right?
So, you got Edmonton and all those teams, all the glorified teams, and, that team in 1970-71, I would have blown them all away.
I wanted to ask you about the WHA.
WHA was something that made up rules as they went along. They weren't very well organized. They were fighting against an old, deeply rooted franchises in Chicago and Boston and Philly. They meant well. And when I took on free agency without compensation, everybody today is a free agent because Derek Sanderson took it to court and won free agency without compensation. The clause, the key, is without compensation. Judge Higginbottom stopped it. Bobby Hull in Philadelphia. I went to a friend of mine who is a politician. He said, you tell them to bring the venue to Suffolk County where the Bruins are. Change of venue is a reason why you have free agency today.
Before you signed that contract to play in Philadelphia in the WHA, you went and visited Weston Adams, and he said, "You'll rue the day that you took this money, Derek." What do you think?
You'll rue the day, son. He says, "If you take this money and don't treat it with respect, you have not been bred to money. You don't understand its corruptive power." What he was trying to do as a friend, not insult me.
Right.
Not hierarchy, not rich people talking to poor. He goes, son, you don't understand. Derek, this money has a corruptive power. And if you don't give it to a money manager and put it in escrow and act like you're only making 30, 40, 50,000, if you start spending it, it just spends well. It spends quick. But here is the beauty of a man who's disciplined. A lesson learned, I hope I did it properly in the book. Because he said to me, I said, and I didn't look too happy. And he said, you don't look like you really want to go. And I said, tell you the truth, sir, all my friends are here. And I owe you this. You were very good to me when I was 15. And I owe you this. My father raised me to be loyal. And I want to be loyal. He says, am I to understand that you would stay with the Bruins? And I wanted $80,000. And the Bruins only would pay me $75,000. That's what I was budgeted at. So I was holding out. The only reason I was didn't have a contract. And he said, would you sign with the team? He says, I really admire your loyalty. Your dad raised you well. And we've had this discussion before, sir. He said, yeah, we have. He said, Taya, I'm excited. Under the circumstances, I'll give you the 80. Now, when you're out for $2.65 million, and the man says to you, well, under the circumstances, we'll give you the 80. That I went from $75,000 to $80,000 because I had this $2.65 million contract hovering over his head. And that statement, you got to love. You got to love the man. And you got it right then. Tells me why he's successful and brilliant and a businessman. There's a price tag here. And no, we don't overspend here.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was great. He said, would you do me a favor? And I said, sure. Would you sign with my son? Because he had cancer. Nobody's business, but he had cancer and he was dying. He didn't feel well. He said, would you sign with my son? I said, sure. He said, it would help to bring the other players into the fold, bring them back from this nonsense. I said, sure. I said, would you do me a favor? He said, yeah. He said, I don't want the Bruins attorney in the room. I don't want him to get any credit for this signing. He says, I promise you won't be in the building. Went to Boston, went up to Busty Senior. I never even dreamed of going back to Philadelphia. I wasn't going to get the money up. And I'm standing there, and Weston Jr. passed me the standard player's contract, no personal bonuses, all team bonuses, like I always had since I was 15. Only team, nothing personal. And he handed it to me, says, well, I really want you to know I respect your loyalty, like your grandmother's death, you know? And I said, no, I said, I'll tell you what. If they ever find out I turned down $2.5 million to play for you for 80, they're going to put me in Bridgewater, which is an insane asylum down the road. And Charlie Mulcahy stuck, I put a pen to paper, started the D, and Charlie Mulcahy, he stuck his head in the door and said, I still think you're only worth 75. Then I said, fuck you. And I said, big mistake, Les. And I laughed. He goes, no, Derek, no, wait, please, no. It wasn't the promise that I was told. It was my out. And now I don't have my Bruins. I got $2.5 million if I want it, because it was already signed. I asked them to sign it. All the clauses were initialed. And I went back to them, and I walked in the door, and the guy was very eager. And let's get her started. They wanted the league going, and that was it.
But you were pretty miserable in Philadelphia, weren't you?
Yeah. I was alone. I had no friends. Life is about friends and family. Life is about real things, tangible things. It drags you day to day. You hold on to yourself, but it turns you into an animal. and off you go. It's just different world. But it ruins you. It destroys you. You try to be a better player than what you're capable of being because you're paid so much. And it just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense.
And you were the highest paid athlete in the world for a short time.
Yeah. I said, give me 2.65, I'll be the highest paid athlete in the world. It did.
So after you made you weren't in the, you know, the WHA was kind of a big debacle, and then you went back to the NHL, and when you landed with the Rangers.
The New York Rangers, I played for Emil Franz.
Killed penalties, great times, had to be shorthanded. I did what I was supposed to do. But New York, no better friend than a converted enemy. The people were great. Really, truly great. The fans accepted me. They were good people. I hung out with them. New York is a great place to play. I had a good year, but I had a bad coach. Ron Stewart. And it's an old story. I was a rookie at 18 years old. He brought me up to play in Maple Leaf Gardens. And he made a fool of me. He just knelt down in front of me. Says, what are you, the great messiah? You're going to take us out of the woods, are you? Because they were sixth place 6 years in a row. And I said, I didn't know what to say. So I went to my cocky side. I said, well, somebody has to. You morons can't get out of your own way. Which didn't endear me to the team. But I wanted to embarrass him like he was embarrassing me. And where do I end up? Price is boating life, and he's my coach. And he told Francis, he said, we got six centermen. We got to get rid of one. But I want rid of Sanderson. He says, because I played a year for Emil Francis. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he was coach the next year. Ricky Middleton was my right wing.
I don't know. Came to camp with a bit of an attitude, but we won the Grapefruit League in scoring. Him and I were 1-2. And he said, he wanted to get rid of me. And Francis said, no, he played well for me. Pick somebody else. And he says, no, you want me to be coach, get rid of him. And so my problem with Stewart just was compounded. Emil said, I'm sorry, but that's what he wants. And I said, okay. And I went to St. Louis. I had my best year ever in St. Louis.
And how did you like living in St. Louis, like, as far as the lifestyle change?
Loved it. Great city. Unbelievable. People. I had a friend of mine, Walt Kachuk, who was a superstar in Phoenix, and he called me up. He got traded to St. Louis. And he said, oh, Turk, I'm dead. I said, let me tell you something. St. Louis is the greatest city in the world to play in. Because what do you mean? Your wife and kids will love St. Louis. Oh, super warm, sweet people.
So let me ask you about when did things start to get out of control, not in your hockey career, but in your personal life?
Well, the summertime I used to get goofy. They always straighten up the season. The summertime I get goofy, party too hard. And then the next thing I knew, I couldn't stop the partying. I couldn't stop the using at 77. I used the cocaine, and vodka, and I was drinking heavy. And, you know, once I started that little gambit, I started bouncing around from St. Louis, Kansas City, to Vancouver, to Pittsburgh, Detroit. They weren't my kind of people. And when I left the Bruins, same with New York, I really missed that mindset we had with the Bruins. But, hey, that's my fault. That's not fair.
What was the mindset?
The mindset, the dedication, hockey, that's it.
you come to play every day, Bobby Orr. That, you know, Bobby Orr never let that team stray. We can all have our fun. We can all do our thing. But he did not let that team stray. There was a dedication, a focus.
There was always, we stayed together. That'll never happen again with the charters and the no layovers. I see drones today. They get on the charter with their iPod and they're, that's it. They don't even talk to each other.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. What do you think, like, the team camaraderie is like in the NHL these days?
All of them. They're all the same. I talked to Keith. I talked to the old-time hockey player. It's all the same. You got the foreigners who can't speak, and then you got the North Americans who want to play for the Cup, and the foreigners want to play for show off and go home early.
Do you think that the are there any foreign players or Russians particularly in the NHL these days that you think play a North American style, or do you think they're all kind of a little too flashy?
Okay, you take Alexander Ovechkin, got more talent, more skill on his baby finger than most people have, doesn't have an attitude. Goes as far as he could go with the puck. It disrupts what the formation is trying to do. People have to adjust to his puck handling skills and all that. He's a great player, but someone has to teach him to play inside a confine, inside the team. No matter how good you are out there, you know, you mean all these superstars. I play against teams with superstars and superstars, but the great equalizer, they only have one puck.
Mm-hmm.
So all these basketball players, when they learn how to pass, that's when you start winning. It's the best game played on any surface.
Do you still enjoy watching it?
We got a problem. I used to think hockey, despite the buffoons that ran it when I came into the game in 65, hockey would always survive. But I don't know anymore.
You think it's in trouble?
Yeah. These goaltenders are really, really good. And they won't call their equipment. They won't take these square pads that don't. You remember when I played with Jerry Cheevers in the Hall of Famer, right? He had bone bruises on his chin, all over his body. He had a catcher's. You know when you saw catchers play and they had that little jock thing that went down between?
Yeah.
That's what he played with. So, when you got hit, you got hit. He had inconsequential. Lining of a jacket is better than what Cheevers wore under a sweater. When he caught, he used a first baseman's glove. And the trainer just happened to sew on a front guard with a plastic plate. It just caught him in the wrist.
So you think that the equipment's just way too out of control now?
Way too out of control. You know why? I want to charge. Helmets cost $165. You know? And they have not one defined. They have yet designed a helmet for a child. All they are, right, is adult helmets put on children. No one has ever designed the definitive helmet yet. Rydell football helmet took on the task, and we took them public, and they wanted money because they want to get in the hockey helmet business. Their research and development went out and said the game is played at too fast the speed. The only thing to protect you is respect for your opponent. And, you know, in my day, we all respected each other. Keith Magnuson, who I fought,
Aunt Ness, I have nothing but respect. We always treat each other civilly off the ice. You know why? Because you know the guy is you know what he does. You know what he did to get there. The sacrifice. What he gave up to be a player. Social life, education, everything. He gave up everything. The hours alone, just to practice, the drill, just to handle a puck and move it. And, you know, play within the system. So no one took a chance of hurting anybody. I don't want to give you a dinger. I don't want to give you a concussion. I want to hit you. I want to intimidate you. But I don't want to maim you. I don't want to hurt you.
Do you think there's any respect between the players in the NHL these days?
No, I saw a guy from Ottawa. I watched this Art Boyle. With Art Boyle? Number 22 for the Rangers.
Oh, Brian Boyle?
Brian Boyle.
I watched Brian Boyle fight along the boards, and he was in a little melee, fighting for the puck, and he did a nice job, and he had an Ottawa senator right in front of him. So what he had to do is not only beat the senator that was to his right, he had a guy to get it and then get it out in the open and then cut left. And he stepped out off the shoulder of the Ottawa senator. Well, Harry Neal came from 40 feet right off the bench, nearly killed him. And nothing scares you more than when you don't see it. Mm-hmm. I thought I could see everything. How can I get hit and not see it? And there's just too much of that. You lost Eric Lindros, one of the best players that played. You lost Kariya. You lost Bergeron. You lost Mark Savard. You lost Pat LaFontaine. These guys can play, but the Stars were taken out by goons that just want to just wrap them. You know, you can't take these helmets because they cause concussions. And no one yet has said they do. Talk to Jackie Parker. He'll tell you. Travis Roy is in a wheelchair today because of a helmet. You ever read the book 11 Seconds?
No, I know the story, though.
That was the most innocuous, harmless check. He just do his job taking this guy. But that cage got caught up and snapped.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, the stem of the neck. And you know, Travis, he must have gone fast. It was nothing. Like Dale Earnhardt there, he died in NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
It was a normal, it just fluke. Just right place, right time. Wrong place, wrong time. Well, helmets are, first of all, how do you play hockey? First thing you do with a five-year-old, right? What do you ask them to do with all this stupid modern equipment that's so heavy and cumbersome and barely learn how to skate? You certainly learn how to skate differently. You're not on a pond with your pants, you know? It's a different story. You ask a five-year-old, male or female, to step on this frozen water, balanced on a 16th inch of steel, and 3 inches off of this frozen water. The puck is frozen. It slides on ice. It bounces. It does things. See, the beauty about hockey is, in baseball, they give you the ball. In football, they give you the ball. In basketball, they give you the ball, except for the tip-off. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Hockey. You take it away. No matter how I get it, I got to take it away. You got to fight for every possession. So it's physical contact. It isn't like football. Football is a pussy game. Football, they play for 7-8 minutes. 45 seconds to think about it, and an incompleted pass takes 4 seconds. What are you talking about? They get four downs. How do you stand around with 2.5 minutes left, with 2 minutes left? A minute 36. Okay, that's it. Game's over. No. Wait a minute. You got to fly. No, we don't. take a 45-second, okay, too long, take a penalty, 5 yards. Next. Hockey is a different game. Hockey is a game played by guys with tremendous heart and tremendous courage. And courage is a serious element to playing the game. It isn't meant for the faint of heart. So, now you put helmets on the kids. 1974, when they mandated it, it kind of made common sense, doesn't it? Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it sound like it? You've got a failed doctor, as long as he's got a white coat. You've got a marketing guy and a plastics guy. They're sitting down in New York and saying, geez, we're all broke. What are we going to do? We've got to come up with something. So what they invented? Play on mother's fear. You're not a good mother if you don't protect your child. And what do you stop? What helmets do? Stop scalp lacerations. If you want to do that, then give them a leather covering. Don't overburden a 5-year-old supple neck that isn't very big. It certainly doesn't have defined muscular structure. Send the kid out, and then he's got an adult helmet and a cage and all this stuff on his head, and his center of gravity's changed, and it doesn't stop concussions. It causes concussion.
Why do you say that?
Newton's third law. It's physics. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. When the centripetal force, or centripetal, depending how you count it, the brain floats in fluid. It is going 30 miles an hour. It is abruptly stopped. The brain continues going. The helmet makes contact where your skull wouldn't, because your eyes tell you, uh-oh, danger, and you turn your neck. You don't make contact. You roll your shoulders, you hunch, you protect. All right? People don't understand that. I was sitting here watching Versus television, and six guys on the panel pontificating about the better helmet, what's good, what's other. What do you do? Not one of them ever played without a helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Respect for your opponent. Play tough, but don't go around maiming them. Don't take a run at them from 40 feet. Charging is a penalty that's called in hockey in 1950. It was designed two aggressive steps in the direction with the intent to hit your opponent. With or without the puck. Certainly without the puck you were charged. But if you had the puck, they looked at the kind of aggressiveness that you approached it. wasn't leaving your feet. Watch everybody in slow motion. When you really watch a slow motion replay, two people hit, first thing you do is leave your feet. You hit, you go in the air. It's just asinine. And it's being run and controlled by people who never played the game without a helmet.
Or maybe who just never played the game, period.
Yes. And I talked to a friend of mine, Harry Sinden, who's looking at, he looked around the room at the rules committee, and nobody played hockey.
I mean, what do you think of Gary
Bettman?
They're
all making these decisions. Gary Bettman's making these decisions about speed up the game. Isn't it entertaining? Sending it back. Let's put the blue line back 3.5 feet. That's 7 feet. I can't cover you when it's that far. The goaltender can't go here, but he can go there. What are you doing? Now, I want to make an analogy for you. What's the difference between basketball and hockey? And Bettman being a basketball guy, what do you think the chances are that I asked him to make basketball courts 25 feet longer and 20 feet wider? Well, what happened?
Well,
so much for the Duncan and the 7-footer.
Yeah.
He's gone. The ball handler, the passer, the dribbler, he comes back. Now, when you look at in basketball, what excites the fans? The dunk. It's just the stupidity of how people analyze.
Overall, what do you think the book's about?
The book is about fear and coping with it and handling it and dealing with it. And I go through it in many and varied ways and try to get people to kind of understand what fear is. Because fear is what molds them. You know the expression when you're a kid, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me?
Yeah.
Sticks and stones don't hurt you. Names hurt you. Bullies hurt you. You don't like your height, your weight, your hair when you're 9, 12, 14 years old. You're gangly, you're ugly, your teeth are spaced, you got pimples, and you don't like your haircut, and you can't afford it, and you get a bowl cut, and you look like a jerk. And so people don't understand. That hurts, you know? I mean, you live your first 5 years of your life, 6 years of your life, like, everybody, I came home one day and I saw my niece and everybody, I see a picture on the refrigerator. And everybody, 9 adults standing there raving about this picture. Isn't this something else? It was a house, a sidewalk, a tree, and grass and sun. I said, well, you could have done better. You could have been more definitive. You could have put a shadow in. And everybody thought I was cruel. I said, well, I'll wait till he runs into the kindergarten. Not only are you ugly, you're stupid, your mother dresses you funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're molded by the insults that you had to face down when you were 7. Nobody there to bail you out. You had to handle it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
9, 12, 14. Who do you hang with? The cool guys, the big guys, are you part of the guys? Are you part of the tech guys? Are you a nerd? Are you what? You know, the athletes get, our schools are set up for 3 types of people. Self-esteem. Athletes, straight-A students, and pretty girls.
Yeah.
Everybody else is fine. That's 96% of our student population. Fights every day for some kind of kudo, a little pat in the back, some kind of, am I alive, you know? So when you get a little older and you're now in workforce or college or you hang and you gravitate to 4 or 5 people, and if they're drinkers, you're a drunk. And if they're whatever they are, you try to be. You can't, you know, make it happen. So what do? You tell them that it just doesn't work. But you know, there's a lot of things happening in your life. That's what the book was for.
The other thing you talk, one of the last things you talk about in the book is how you kind of you know you got a new lease on life after you got married and had kids of your own.
Girls have figured us out when they're 14. We're about a quarter inch deep, 40 miles wide. There's not a lot to us, is there? Where do you get your purpose in life? Your wife, you follow in love, and you say, okay, you want to please her. She wants children, she wants family, mortgage, bills. And you provide. You protect and provide.
What does the future hold for you, and will you also talk about the movie that's being made about your life?
I really don't have a say. That's what you do with sobriety. You let go and you let God. And I do not mention religion. If you notice in this book.
Yeah.
Religion is man's word. That's all a con. Creflo Dollar. All these evangelists with the tent making a buck. And then they say, buy my CD. And what's his name goes up in the tower, the devil's going to take me if you don't give me $10 million. He got it.
What about this? Can you tell me about the movie that's going to be made about the book?
Well, the movie, Eddie Burns is playing my father. Doug Atchison is an Academy Award winning director. he rewrote the script three times in the last 4 months, trying to get it to where he wants it to be. If the movie is done right and proper, it's an era piece. People really don't understand how life was then. You have to remember, I was 1968, 67, 68, turned pro in Boston Bruins, Daisy Buchanan's and Bachelor's 3. 18-year-old, 24-year-old male was in Vietnam fighting a war on a draft they didn't want to go to.
So the movie's going to be about you, but it's also going to be about the times that were going on.
It'll be about the times. It'll be about friendship. It'll be about redemption. It'll be about patience, humility. Let go, let God. There's a lot of fun in it. There's a lot of fun stories. There's a lot of craziness. But there's some violence and there's some a dodge of bullets here and there. But, you know, when you're drinking, that's all you have is that you're bad. And that really can cause some problems. That's all you have left at the bottom of a bottle is that you're mean.
Is there any word on who's going to play you?
Well, I tell you the truth. I watched the other day John Carter.
Uh-huh.
Taylor Kitsch, I'd like to play me.
What's his name?
Taylor Kitsch.
Okay.
Friday Night Lights, and he played hockey in Vancouver. So at least he could skate.
Right.
At least he can play. He can shoot. So he can do things that he would be the ideal guy in my mind. My niece picked him, as a matter of fact. She said, Taylor Kitsch, you gotta get Taylor Kitsch. He's kind of a bad boy and he wants to get away from it. But I think if he sees him, he reads the script, I think they can talk him into it. I don't know. That's not my world. I don't know that world.
I mean, will you be on? Do you want to have a part in it, like on set and stuff, or will you just kind of sit back and let them take care of it?
No, if it's going the wrong way, I'll say my piece and walk off. But we'll see. We'll see.
But they're going to shoot that up in Boston, right?
Yeah, in the Brown Arena. So they're going to shoot it. They're going to shoot it. A lot of friends of mine will be in it from around Boston. Keith Kachuk and his sons, Braden and Matthew, are going to play me in my backyard when they were like 10, 12.
Oh, cool.
And their teammates will be fooling around in the backyard. We'll make a rink for them and some authenticity and the kids doing stuff.
That's cool. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that movie.
Well, Doug Atchison is just a professional. He knows his stuff. He knows what he wants. And it'll go to where it goes on his strength alone. When he sees it's time to go. And right now, we're raising the money. It's independent. We're trying it ourselves. You can turn the story over, and they'll write whatever they want to write.
Right.
I don't want anyone to take advantage of Bobby Orr and do whatever they say. I wouldn't let that happen. He's a dear friend, both on and off, and I protect him like he protects me.